are you with Truth News Radio on the 25th of September 2013, and I'm your host, Harrowood Fenton. Welcome to another show. For the next 2 hours, we will be engaging in some discussion and analysis of a variety of very important topics. I have in the second hour a terrific guest coming on, Kevin Miller, filmmaker, been on my show a couple of times before, the director of the groundbreaking film Generation RX, which was released about 4 or 5 years ago now. He's coming on the show to talk about his newest film, which is a sequel to Generation RX, and it's called Letters from Generation RX, and it's a follow-up on all of the work he did in that amazing film, returning to some of the expert testimony as well as some of the testimony from people who have had life-shattering experiences after taking psychiatric medications. Kevin is a man who has great respect for science, great respect for information without, biasing it with beliefs or belief systems, ideologies. He simply wants to get at the truth of the phenomenon that we've seen with this massive rise in the number of people on a variety of medications and the undeniable evidence of the effect it's had, including many, many deaths, but including the disruption of people's lives. And the direct correlation between these serious life-shattering problems and the actual medications that people are taking. I mean, it's a case of iatrogenic illness that is masked by the fact that we generally only ever get the information about this from mainstream sources. So, of course, when people are on antidepressant meds and they commit suicide, it's simply presented as, well, you know, that's what people do when they're depressed, they commit suicide. And yet, the underlying fact, and this is really a fact, it's not actually just an opinion, is that that these medications increase suicide. They increase violence. They increase suicidal ideation. They have a variety of aberrant, very disturbing effects on the human psyche. And yet, despite that, the take-up of these drugs is still on the increase. And, of course, that is a testament to the degree in which our society has been taken over by this medical-industrial complex, this regime of medicalizing all forms of human discomfort so that people only think to turn to some sort of pill to solve a problem. Whereas things like, you know, different approaches to one's personal health, whether it be actually just physiological health or mental health, different approaches are minimized and in some cases quite aggressively suppressed by the health authorities and the governments. And I'll be getting into some of that with Kevin Miller in the second hour, so I do hope you can join us for that discussion. It's going to be quite interesting, and we'll be going through his latest film and just talking about the general difficulties that he's had with this, encountering the block and the cognitive dissonance that so many people have about things that are really quite undisputed. Now, in the meantime, I would like to spend a bit of time today talking about climate change, another subject which is suffused in cognitive dissonance and inability of many to simply look at facts. And I'd like to actually just take a step back here with the whole climate change question. I mean, it's a good time to revisit it after having an election in Australia which has swept away the former government, which was extremely climate alarmist in its general standpoint, which had brought in various measures to reduce human greenhouse emissions, including the carbon tax, including the bodies that were basically overseeing green energy usage in Australia. A lot of that has now been abolished. The new government doesn't deny the importance of reducing what they call energy efficiency, but they're not talking much at all about the concept of carbon emissions, the concept of carbon footprint. And this is what I kind of want to focus in on today in the first hour. And I know in many cases I'm going to be preaching to the choir. I know that many people don't need to be reminded of this, but bear in mind that there are many listeners to this show who actually, although they agree with what we talk about on many topics, actually have argued against my position on climate change. And I find that surprising because I think I have the same approach to looking at climate change, the same methodical, empirical approach to climate change as I have to many other topics. And yet what I find is that some people really are attached to this idea that that we should reduce pollution and that we therefore should support the idea that reducing carbon emissions is a good thing, because they think pollution is a bad thing and that if we reduce carbon emissions, we'll be reducing pollution. And they also think that in a world with a growing population, I've had this informal feedback from many people who've spoken to me over the years, there's a perception that in a world with a growing population, that we have to find a more energy efficient forms of industry, more energy efficient ways of doing everything. Otherwise, the world will simply not be able to sustain itself. That will have various environmental catastrophes, of which global warming is one. And this is, you know, one general position that a lot of people have, even though they may not be strong, hardline believers in the core arguments of the IPCC. But there's a big problem with that whole sphere of thinking. And the angle I want to approach it from in today's show is I want to go back to looking at the concept of the greater good and the concept of personal sacrifice, because this is the core of most of the arguments on a political level for why we must engage in some sort of drastic change in the way we do things. Whether that be through enforced reductions of emissions or through some sort of taxation scheme or emissions trading scheme. There is a belief that we must sacrifice and we'll have to pay some sort of price in the loss of some of our enjoyments in order to save the planet, as it were, for the future. And when you look at that on a superficial level, it sounds really good. Like, it's good language. It sounds noble, right? And it is noble to make a personal sacrifice for the greater good. I do not dispute that that is a noble thing to do if you choose to do it. And that there, my friends, is the rub, as Shakespeare would say. Because the thing about sacrifice, the thing about doing something for the greater good, is it's something that you do, that one does as a personal gesture. When it becomes mandated, that's a very different thing indeed, isn't it? When it becomes mandated from above that we all must sacrifice for the greater good, what does that start to sound like? It starts to sound a little bit like Mao and the Cultural Revolution, doesn't it? You know, it starts to sound a little bit like Stalin. It starts to sound a little bit like Hitler. And I would propose to you that, in fact, the arguments about all the changes that we must make and the sacrifices we must make for the benefit of the environment are indeed fascist arguments. They always were, and they always will be, part of a fascist belief system. Now, a lot of people in the environmental causes would be shocked to hear this, and they'll think I'm being ridiculous. They'll say I'm carrying on, how can you compare us to Nazis or whatever? And yes, you know, the comparisons really are there. It's just that you don't see it when you're in it. You only see it when you've stepped out of it. When you're in the collectivist, statist mindset, you cannot see the world a different way. Everything becomes this idea of the greater good being equivalent to the supra-individual organizing force that has to make sure that the world works safely. Otherwise, there will be some kind of disaster. Implicit in that, just think about it, implicit in that is a lack of trust, a fear almost of the individual and what the individual might do if the individual was simply free to run around and do whatever they felt like. It's very deep, and I think it may derive from some kind of tribal imprint that we have. It may be at the DNA level, I don't know. It may be purely cultural, but there is a fear, and I see it in many people when we discuss this topic. There is a fear of the individual. But, you know, we've been through different phases of human civilization, folks, and this is what's really interesting. We've been through different phases of human civilization where the individual and individuality has had a kind of renaissance and then has kind of ebbed back into this kind of retreat into only trusting with the collective. And it's kind of a seesaw motion that we've seen over centuries. And we could look back to the early Greek civilizations as one of the earliest historically documented flowerings of the belief in the individual. And then we see in subsequent periods of hundreds of years, we see a decline again back to a much more totalitarian types of systems such as we had in the Roman Empire, and then the medieval era being extremely controlled by regimes and dogmas. And we saw then, of course, the Renaissance, which occurred around about the 15th century. And we saw again the resurgence of that belief in the human individual, the individual human spirit. And you know, each time we see this in history, the resurgence of the individual is when it seems to me that we have the greatest breakthroughs and the greatest discoveries, the greatest advancements in the true greater good of humanity. But they're often opposed stridently by the powers that be at the time. I mean, look at Galileo and the whole, you know, heliocentric, geocentric debate there. I believe we're going through another such period at the moment, and I'd like to get into that more throughout the show. So do stay with us. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. We're just going to break, but we'll be back very soon.
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Back you with Truth News Radio. I'm talking about climate change today. A bit of a break from looking at the crisis in the Middle East, which has certainly been dominating the show for the past few weeks. You know, if I had time, I would cover so many more stories on this show, but we only do one show every week. And I'm generally driven to talk about whatever is at the tip of the spear in terms of international events. But I think this week we're going to give that a break. And I want to continue talking about climate change and environmentalism, but I want to come at it from a different angle. I've got an article here written by Martin Durkin, the director of a great documentary called The Great Global Warming Swindle, which came out a few years ago. And this article illustrates something I was talking about in the previous segment about the incongruous, one might think, connection between fascism and environmentalism. Now, as I was saying before, many people, especially Greens, would be horrified to think that there was any connection there. And yet, you know, there is scholarly, there is solid historical evidence for a connection there that goes right back to the origins of the environmental movement. Now, I'd like to read to you from this article here by Martin Durkin. It's titled Nazi Greens, An Inconvenient History. Two disturbing stories recently on the Greens. First, Spiegel magazine runs an article on the rise of extremist right-wing environmentalism in Germany. Then, the Observer newspaper reveals that in the name of preventing climate change, British aid money to India is paying for the forced sterilization of poor people. These are shocking stories, but not so shocking to those familiar with the story of Nazi environmentalism. Let's step back in time. Picture the scene. At the edge of a forest, German soldiers point their guns at rows of naked people who follow the Jewish religion. Among them are young mothers clutching their babies. The shots echo through the woods and the dead bodies fall to the ground. Down the road, while this is happening, their German army comrades are busy establishing nature walks and bird sanctuaries and planting trees. The Nazis conducted horrific experiments on children. But at the same time, they banned medical experiments on animals. The same Nazi monsters who committed crimes of unimaginable barbarity also advocated vegetarianism, organic agriculture, forest preservation, and homeopathic healthcare. How can we possibly explain this? What was the connection between the inhuman brutality of the Nazis and their gushing idealization of nature? The purpose of exploring a Nazi environmentalism is not just to upset the Greens. If environmentalism were a curious but peripheral aspect of National Socialism, it would be of no real historic interest. Environmentalists could be forgiven for saying, "Ah, well, it just goes to show there's a little bit of good in the worst of us." But environmentalist ideology was not an accidental, optional extra to National Socialism. As we shall see, green ideas were at the core of Nazi thinking. The German Volk and Nazi movements marched beneath the banners of nature and the organic. However, what follows here is not simply a potted history of Nazi environmentalism. It is, at the same time, a brief history of early environmentalism writ large. As will become clear, it is not so easy to draw a line between the two types of green thinking. To understand why green ideology emerged at all, and why it happened in Germany, we need to go back in time a few centuries to set the scene. We have described elsewhere in this blog the transition from feudal society to capitalism. To the Greens, this great historical change is more or less the source of all evil. In Germany, it was a process which began falteringly in the 13th century. Historically, a rise in commercial activity is reflected in the growth of towns. During this century, the number of them in Germany increased about tenfold. But the towns in Germany were less of a liberating force than they had been in England. German feudal society was especially rigid. Professor of German history Mary Fulbrook describes how Germany had a much more immobile social hierarchy and was more caste-ridden than either England or France. The liberty of the towns was more bitterly opposed by the German nobles, the increasing wealth of the new commercial classes more keenly resented, and the desperate attempts by the serfs to obtain their freedom more fiercely resisted. The German nobles despised the fledgling class of burghers or bourgeois in the towns, and the burghers hated them right back. As Fulbrook says, German burghers tended to be anti-noble in outlook and did not leave the towns to become country gentry as in England. Nevertheless, the very existence of market towns in Germany, little bastions of liberty, was enough to instill in the serfs the hope of freedom. In the 1520s, the peasants rose up. The Great Serf Revolt became known as the Peasants' War and the Revolution of the Common Man. By 1525, 300,000 peasant serfs had armed themselves. Well-organized peasant armies of between 2,000 and 15,000 went into the field, demanding the abolition of feudal dues and an end to the privileges of the nobles. In a word, freedom. As with the famous Peasants' Revolt in England, the serfs enjoyed support from the towns, and like the Peasants' Revolt, they met with stiff resistance from the feudal ruling class. But the suppression of the serf uprising by the German nobles was especially ferocious. Around 100,000 peasants were slaughtered, and many more were blinded and maimed. Larger economic forces also conspired against the serfs winning their freedom. The opening up of the Americas drew European trade towards the Atlantic seaboard. Overland trade routes across Germany became less important. Markets shrank, and many German towns fell into decline and even disappeared. As Professor Blanning says in his Big History of Early Modern Europe, a pattern was emerging. It was the urbanized West that serfdom, in the urbanized West, that serfdom disappeared earliest, and it was in the rural East, where one could travel for weeks without encountering anything resembling a town, that it not only survived, but periodically enjoyed new leases of life. In Germany, the power of the nobles, as against the towns and their serfs, was further enhanced by the devastating 30 Years' War, which proved to be a key event in German history. The war itself brought trade to a near standstill, and to make matters worse, to pay for the war, ruinous taxes were imposed on commercial activity. As the historian Professor Gordon Craig describes, the war greatly strengthened the privileged position of the aristocracy at the expense of the educated and prosperous burgher class and the peasantry. The decline of towns and the consequent decrease in the demand for food caused so sharp a fall in grain prices that small landowners were often forced to sacrifice their independence in order to maintain themselves. The local nobility was able to take advantage of this situation to impose new obligations in the form of rents and services and restrictions upon movement. But of most significance was the political settlement which followed the war. Professor Fulbrook points out, the settlement which finally emerged in 1648 set patterns with long-lasting consequences for German history. Now, I'm going to continue with this after the break. I do hope you can bear with me. It's a long article here, and I'm probably not going to get through the whole thing, but I want to present it to you in as much detail as I can, because the argument and the facts behind it are quite solid. And with Truth News Radio Australia, it's great talking to you today. I'll be back really soon after these ads. welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. I've been reading to you from an article here by Martin Durkin, a filmmaker, extremely well-written article, which ties together the environmental movement, the modern environmental movement, with a German history going back many centuries, but having its roots in the Volk movement, which began in the 19th century, which itself grew out of a number of historical developments, the most crucial of which was the abolition of serfdom. And the article goes through a lot of the history of this, which I don't have time to read through. I was in the previous section going through the beginning of that process and the various peasant uprisings and then wars that were then fought to regain control from the aristocracy and the increasingly large state that developed with powerful standing armies, which in the latter centuries became the controlling factor in serfdom and feudalism. And then the final abolition of serfdom, which caused a backlash again from the aristocracy and from those who felt that they were losing control of the entire human society. And he refers to Thomas Malthus here as examples of intellectuals who were sort of representing the position of the aristocracy, horrified at the growth in everything that was taking place with the rise of modern industrial society and, of course, the population growth. And really, at the root of that, what they saw as the threat to their own seat of power. And amongst all of that, we had in Germany the rise of what was called the Volk movement. And this had some prominent intellectual figures, such as Nietzsche, who championed it. And it is from the Volk movement that Martin Durkin argues that the modern green movement had its roots in Germany. So let me just continue now reading here. I've just skipped here through the article to the point at which he starts discussing the Volk movement in depth. From the start, Volkish ideology had what we would recognize today as a green tinge. The Volkish writer Friedrich Neratzel said, "As different from each other as plants, animals, and human beings may be, they all stand and move on the same soil. They came to life on the same soil. Life is always bound to the earth and cannot, partially or as a whole, be separated from the earth and its soil." The Volk, the people, had a deep, mystical, essential bond with each other and the earth. They said the true Volk society was connected with the soil. It was organic and natural, determined by nature, shaped by earthly forces and conditions, inseparable from the earth itself. The landscape had formed the people, and their culture was part of the landscape. The Volkists spoke of a healthy society's rootedness. In Nietzsche, we find the usual Volkish green simpering about nature. "Remain faithful to the earth," demands Zarathustra. "We must reanimalize man and return to nature." As Professor Moss observes, the word rootedness occurs constantly in their vocabulary. They sought this in spiritual terms through an inward correspondence between the individual, the native soil, the Volk, and the universe. Rural rootedness served as a contrast to urban dislocation, or what was termed uprootedness. Volkish thinkers like Riehl, Paul Lagarde, Heinrich von Tritzke and others looked back to the earlier Germans with nostalgia for their ordered social and economic life. These olden days had become times of rootedness, when the nation, composed of craftsmen and nobles, warriors and tillers of the soil, enjoyed its labours and prospered under the benefits of a settled hierarchy. Of course, it is no accident that this sudden enthusiasm for social rootedness appears immediately after serfdom is abolished. The yearning for rootedness was nothing other than the desire to keep the peasants tied to the land. Rootedness was a perfect description of feudal society. The nobles were rooted to the land. They even derived their names from their feudal domains. And of course, their serfs were legally tied to them and to the land. It was forbidden for serfs or their children to leave their lord's land, or indeed to marry without the lord's permission. They were rooted in a very real and very unpleasant way. The serfs stayed serfs from generation to generation. It was in their blood. Their status was inherited and legally enforced. And the aristocrats stayed noble from one generation to the next, no matter how inept or imbecilic. Their privileges were a blood right. A lord was as different to a peasant as a horse was to a dog. The age-old social order seemed to them as natural as the trees. And bear in mind that what is being argued here, and this is me speaking now, this is Hereward Fenton speaking, what is being argued here is that the Volk movement had its origin in this kind of longing and indeed a desperate need of the powers that be to get back into control. And there is a smooth continuum between the Volkist movement and the rise of fascism and the emergence of what we now call environmentalism. But let us continue. The Volkist H.S. Chamberlain said that society and our respective class positions within it had evolved and were therefore natural. Nobody acquainted in detail with the results of animal breeding can doubt that the history of mankind before us and around us obeys the same law. Volkish anti-capitalism was not on the side of the masses, quite the opposite. The Volkists saw capitalism, rightly, as the great liberator of the masses. It was this liberation which was unnatural to them. As one of them put it, nature is a many splendid thing, but one aspect will not be found in nature, equality. And again, we have shades here of social Darwinism. Not so much the theory of evolution, but social Darwinism, which was the main impact of Darwin's ideas in his own time and in subsequent generations. In his great work, The Destruction of Reason, the philosopher George Lukacs pointed out that the idealization of nature and the organic was, from the very beginning, political. It was, he pointed out, an attempt to defend naturally grown feudal privileges. Biologism in philosophy and sociology has always been a basis for reactionary philosophical tendencies. It cannot permit of any essential change, let alone progress. Oppression, inequality, exploitation, and so forth were presented as facts of nature or laws of nature, which as such could not be avoided or revoked. Society was naturally hierarchical. Nietzsche even insisted, in the last resort, there exists an order of rank of states of soul, and there is no point of aspiring to achieve a higher rank because one has to be born, or, expressed more clearly, be bred for it. One is superior by virtue of one's origin, one's ancestors, and one's blood. People in different classes had different blood. They were indeed a different race. For Volkish thinkers, the terms race and class amounted to the same thing. And Nietzsche lamented that Europe had been plunged through the demographic mingling of classes and races. Now, I'll be continuing with this from the next break. I do hope you're finding it interesting. I certainly am. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're with Truth News. I'm reading to you an article by Martin Durkin which outlines the origins of the Green Movement in German society and the Volk Movement, with the major kind of cradle of that being the Nazis, who formalized the Volk Movement into a kind of political ideology. Now, I'm actually going to jump again ahead in the article because it's a very long article and unfortunately I just can't really bring to you the depth of what's contained in it, but I'm reading to you some highlights from it. And I'm moving forward now to where he begins to actually talk about the connection between the Volkist and the Nazis and the environmental idealism that inspired. Just as today's Greens idealise pre-capitalist societies, so did the Volkists and the Nazis. Their blood and soil racism was wholly the product of this backward fantasy. It was nothing more than the desire to cling onto the world as it was before. As with the Nazis' demonisation of Jewish people, it was an expression of their fear and loathing of the physical and social mobility which came with capitalism. Like Nietzsche and the Volkists, Hitler and the Nazis hated the Enlightenment. They rejected its humanism just as they spurned the human-centred morality of the Judeo-Christian tradition. They despised the moral restraints of civilization and embraced the romance of pagan savagery as more authentic. They held bourgeois liberal tolerance and internationalism or globalization in contempt. They were all features of the despised new capitalist order. The Volkist deep hatred of capitalism extended to all the trappings of industrial and urban development. As Moss says, these sick individuals, the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, had subsequently stamped their surroundings with diseased characteristics. The result was an unhealthy, degenerate landscape marked by smoking factories, overcrowded cities, and insatiable natural resource exploitation. The Volkists hated advertising billboards and hydroelectric dams and railway lines. They hated modern farming techniques and the mass production of food. They idealized peasant life. In short, the Volkists and Nazis were green. In 1934, a year after the Nazis took power, as Professor Thomas Leacon describes, they declared that the Third Reich had ushered in a new era of environmental stewardship. They foresaw a new era of organic land use planning that stressed long-term sustainability over short-term profitability. The leading Nazi Walther Stoenneken declared that the German countryside was to be purified of the un-German spirit of commerce. The same year they passed a law concerning the protection of the racial purity of the forest plants. And the following year, the wide-ranging Reich Nature Protection Law. Now let's just pause to reflect a little bit on this concept of the racial purity of forest plants, because we hear a lot about this in Australia when we talk about in preservation of native vegetation and how important that is. And isn't it incredible to think that the origins of that concept, and I'm really literally saying the origins of that concept, were in eugenics. But we don't use the term racial purity anymore. But that is essentially what we're talking about. When we talk about preserving a native vegetation in Australia at the expense of imported vegetation, we are actually applying a type of eugenics to our own environment. It's fascinating, isn't it? Just continuing here from the article. Hitler appointed his most trusted general, Hermann Göring, Supreme Commissioner for Nature Conservancy, and made him Reich Forest Minister, Reich Minister of Forestry, whose job it was to promote forest-mindedness and the close-to-nature ideals of the eternal forest. Göring declared, "The people are a living community, a great organic eternal body," which was echoed in the Nazi slogan, "Ask the trees, they will teach you how to become national socialists." As Moss says, in Völkisch thought, the image of the tree was constantly used to symbolize the peasant strength in the Volk, with roots anchored in the past, while the crown aspired to the cosmos and its spirit. Now, I just want to pause again to reflect on what I was saying at the beginning of the program about how the ideology, the dogma about climate change is rooted in this idea of the greater good and personal sacrifice. But I want now to merge that with what we've just been reading and understanding, that this is actually part of a control paradigm that has been in play for many, many hundreds of years, and I'm probably thousands of years. It is about the control paradigm of the ruling classes, because the ruling classes want us to be quite clearly divided into strata, preferably into castes, and they want the peasant to be as different to the ruler as a dog is from a human being. Unfortunately, the imprinting of these ideas in our psyche is still very strong. And many people who are certainly not of the elitist bent, are certainly not the wicked ruling elites, many people who are good-hearted souls are led into this mindset, because it is the mindset, it is the very paradigm of control, and it is the paradigm of control that was probably in their ancestors for generation after generation. And I would put to you that that is possibly why people are so susceptible to it. And that is why we have to use these types of arguments, and articles like this by Martin Durkin are so important, because we've got to educate people step by step. You actually have to understand how this was all programmed into you. It didn't just happen overnight. It didn't just happen in your lifetime. In a sense, you are a breed. I mean, look at the different breeds of dog. The Alsatian, you know, the different, the Dachshund Hound, the sausage dog. They're all quite different, aren't they? And they've got different temperaments. How did that happen? Well, that happened over many, many generations of breeding. They're all just dogs. They're all the same species. But they've been practically turned into what look like different animals. This is what the ruling elites have always wanted with us. But in many cases, they succeeded, and in many cases they failed. And the abolition of serfdom and the rise of capitalism was the greatest blow to their control, but the greatest liberation and the greatest expression of the true potential of humanity that the world has ever seen. Let me just continue reading to you a little more from the article. We're almost at the end of the hour, but another couple of paragraphs, I think. Of course, the green politics of the Nazis, like the policies of the Greens today, were riddled with contradictions. They wanted organic peasant farming, but discovered very quickly that it would not produce nearly enough food. The sprawling Nazi state bureaucracy was a ravenous parasite that needed a host. But the fact that the absurd green fantasies of the Nazis were impractical did not seem to disturb them. Perhaps this was because every bit of green legislation had justified and involved a further extension of planning and state intervention. As Professor Leckan puts it, the discourse of organic planning meshed well with Nazism's corporatist approach to economic intervention. Again, shades very much of what we see these days with environmental legislation and corporate involvement and government involvement. It is important to note that environmentalism and the appeal to nature was at the heart of Nazi belief. As Adolf Hitler insisted in Mein Kampf, man's effort to build up something that contradicts the iron logic of nature brings him into conflict with those principles to which he himself exclusively owes his existence. By acting against the laws of nature, he prepares the way that leads to ruin. There are those Greens who insist that the environmental movement started in 1962, when Rachel Carson published her misguided rant against DDT, Silent Spring. But this is clearly nonsense. To emphasize our point, let us look at the writings of Martin Heidegger, the famous Nazi philosopher. Heidegger contrasts wonderful peasant life, which involved dwelling, with horrid footloose capitalism, which involves homelessness. Heidegger's feudal Eden had been destroyed by capitalism. Bridges, hangars, stadiums and power stations are buildings but not dwellings. Railway stations and highways, dams and market halls are built, but they are not dwelling places. The truck driver is at home on the highway, but he does not have his lodgings there. Heidegger contrasts the crass, modern machine-powered technology that disturbs nature with the healthy use of tools by handicraftsmen, which involves a revealing and unconcealment of nature. Into Heidegger's imagined rural idyll, the poison of market forces is seeping. The forester who measures the felled timber in the woods and who to all appearances walks the forest path in the same way his grandfather did is today ordered by the industry that produces commercial woods. Well, we have run out of time. I hope you got the general gist of what I was saying to you there. The origins of the environmental movement in Volk-ish thought and indeed in fascism and Nazism. And it's not just a coincidence, it's not just an anomaly that they started at the same time. They emerged from the same groundswell. We'll be back for hour two with our interview. Do stay with us, it's going to be a really important hour. We'll be right back.